Thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed the book, Meaning Strategic Intuition. I know you've written three, but that's the first one of the lineup that I've read. And I was wrestling a lot with the idea of intuition, and more so in the context of business and financial markets and investing. I'm trying to figure out, because there is this idea of, okay, expert intuition, it's a thing, but it can lead you astray. And so I was, I guess, fortuitous to bump into your work. Maybe we can start off, if you just give us a little bit of your background on how you came to the topic and why the question of intuition was interesting to you.
Well, intuition, I became interested in intuition as an answer, not as a question.
Okay.
The question was, if you look closely, I was working, I do have a PhD, but I wasn't an academic at the time. I was looking, my job was strategy and innovation, and I was looking deeply into, well, what do those words mean? And it really started with strategy, where I said, okay, so what exactly do you do to develop a strategy? And I found out that almost all of strategy is strategic analysis. You know, how to analyze your situation, analyze the company, analyze this, analyze that, analyze trends, analyze the situation, analyze your own abilities, analyze competitors, and analyze, analyze, analyze. And nobody said, okay, now how do I get an idea? On the other end, strategic planning, right? Strategic planning is very well known. There's lots and lots of strategic planning where you set a goal and then you work out all the activities to reach it. Well, how do you set a goal? Do you set any goal you want? Right? You know, I know if companies were to set any goal they want, I know what goal they would set. Worldwide monopoly.
Right.
Well, then if not that, then what? So what's missing in the middle between analysis and planning is, how do you get the idea? After your analysis, how do you get an idea for what to do? This is not a criticism of analysis, quite the opposite. Great. You've now analyzed everything. Now, how do you get an idea? And on the other side, strategic planning, how do you get an idea that you then develop a plan to implement? And I very quickly realized that so many people were making plans without any idea. You know, what's our goal? You know, what's activity? You know, wait, do you have an idea? So you need an idea before you then plan to implement the idea. So where does the idea come from? And that's what I started researching, and that led me into really the modern neuroscience, which is now really able to answer that question. Before they couldn't. Now they can. MRIs could now see people think starting in the early 90s. And now there's a whole discipline within neuroscience that arose. A journal starts in 1994 called Learning and Memory. And Learning and Memory basically overturns almost everything that came before in how people get ideas. So what we have now is, we have a big divide between the neuroscientists in learning and memory and everybody else who's continuing their previous methods before the revolution in learning and memory.
Okay.
So that's the dilemma.
So what were the implications of that? Is that so intelligent memory, the concept?
Is that all thinking is a form of intuition.
Okay.
You can't have a thought without intuition. By intuition, what do you mean is that in some way your brain makes its own connections. That's really what intuition is. So you take things in and you look at the situation. You take in information and learning, that's what they call it, learning. And then you face any new situation, and you then try to manage what's in your memory with what's in that new situation. And that happens, there's a conscious part to it, but it doesn't really happen consciously. It's that, you know, you try to break it down, and then, you know, that peace comes to you. So intuition is part of all thinking. And, you know, neuroscientists don't call it intuition. They call it association. So all your gray matter, they call it the association cortex, where your brain is making these associations.
And
so the old distinction of rationality versus irrationality, or logic versus intuition, all that's out the window.
That's so interesting, right? Because I think intuitively, I can already feel a little bit of resistance to the idea like, well, I want, you know, my work product to be the end result of this very structured process that I have control over, right? Like if I'm in business or in markets.
But that you're using an old understanding
exactly.
of intuition. You're using a magical notion of intuition versus yes. as you're doing that, you are drawing on what you've learned and observe and what's mm-hmm. in your memory in order to put together your. So if you think you're being logical, it's because you've learned some framework
mm-hmm.
that's in your memory that you're applying to the situation.
Yes.
So tell me. So that application, you know, drawing, you know, that format, you know, that is an organized format, comes from your memory.
And you don't
even realize it.
Right. So this is the important part, right? The not realizing the moment when that happens, when the brain puts that together without conscious effort, right? Maybe you can outline the...
Well, it's happening right now as we speak.
Mm. All the time, you mean?
Yeah. I am able to draw words on English accordingly to communicate with you. That's
sure.
happening through technically intuition.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking of each word,
yeah.
but I am thinking, you know. The process of trying to match this situation with things in my memory is a form of intuition. It's also logical, right? I'm trying to put things together in a logical sequence, but the content comes from my memory. There's no other source.
Yeah. And you're, I guess, if we're going by the four-step process, right? Like, tell me about how you ultimately map this idea on what is ultimately the idea behind the book, right? Strategic intuition, sort of not in the moment, but on a much grander scale.
Yeah. So if we think of novelty, right? Mm-hmm. Novelty, you know, so expert intuition, and you've correctly said what it is. It's that through repetition, things become familiar and you can do them better and faster. And you get really good at things through repetition. What that is that's rapid memory, right? In other words, you know, it comes quickly from your memory. So fast that it seems instant, but it's not instant. It actually takes some minimal amount of time to draw that from your memory to then apply it to the situation. That's expert intuition. It's 99% of what people do. But how does what happens when you find a new, when you're in a new situation that you haven't experienced before, or you want a new idea? You know, you want to be creative and have a new idea. So that's what I'm calling strategic intuition. You could mm-hmm. also call it creative intuition.
Okay.
It's the reason they're so similar is because strategy is about the future. The future is never exactly the same as the past. So for your future strategy, you always need something new. And this expert intuition can't give it to you. Well, it turns out that the novel situations work. It's still learning in memory.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing is you're putting together a unique combination of what's in your memory. So you're putting together, oh, that, plus that, and I'll do that one, and then I'll do that, and oh, now I have this idea for something new. But every piece came from something in your memory. There's no other source. And so that's the distinction I made.
Yeah.
In other words, and that takes, that's much slower. That doesn't happen quickly. Is typically, by definition, it's a more difficult problem because it's new. So it takes more time for your brain to make the associations that put together that new idea. So, you know, there's no alternative to using what is in your memory to decide what to do in your next situation. The question is, how do you make sure in your memory you have what you need for that situation?
Yeah.
And that's where learning isn't just, you know, mostly learning is natural, the way children learn language, but learning is also study.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can learn actively. You can actively learn. And that's the discipline of strategic intuition, to have the humility to say, you know, this is a new situation. This is beyond my experience. I need to search what other people have done in pieces of this problem in order to get the pieces into my memory, that might then give me an idea.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you made the point in the book that history often omits this act of the flash of insight, the eureka moment. It kind of gets lost in the story. And then I felt like you made a very conscious effort to dig up examples in different domains, and it maybe wasn't so easy to identify the different pieces that came into play. So tell me maybe about your favorite examples and about this, you know, what pieces would I have to collect, or how would I go about that study, you know, drawing on not understanding yet what the pieces are that I'll need to figure out this new problem, right? So how does one go about this problem, and how did you?
That's two questions. The first question is, you know, the simplest example is very clear to people. A lot of people think Henry Ford invented the assembly line. He did not. The assembly line was invented 100 years before Henry Ford, at the start of the Industrial Revolution. He invented a certain kind of assembly line, meaning he put together the old assembly line with something new. The old assembly line he took from, was by Oldsmobile. Oldsmobile was the first mass-produced car. And in the old assembly line, the products are lined up. And then the specialized workers move along the product. So Oldsmobile was doing that with cars. So Henry Ford built that kind of factory, you know, where all the cars are lined up and the workers move from car to car. He then sent his engineers out to say, can we make this any faster? And his chief engineer saw the slaughterhouse in a meatpacking in an abattoir and said, oh, look at that. The product moves. The people stay still.
Interesting.
So they put those two things together. They put the old assembly line, the stationary assembly line, and the moving assembly line at the slaughterhouse. And now you have the car moving, and it's, you know, it's massively faster and cheaper. So that's just the simplest, clearest example. And thankfully, Henry Ford said so. It's in his autobiography, right? He said, this is how we did it. Very rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who say what they did, like Steve Jobs, for example, there's lots of interviews where he tells you what he took. I put this and this and this, and that's how I read this. You know, he wasn't an engineer. He never invented anything. Apple doesn't invent things. Apple takes things and puts them together in new combinations. You know, I think the idea is simple enough that, oh, I see, it's a new combination. And I think a lot of people say, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, that's true to what I experience, you know, that my do ideas are really, you know, combinations. And sometimes I feel a little guilty and I thought I wasn't really being creative.
Yeah.
You know, so they say, oh, okay, I feel better. You know, I was being creative. Your second question is a very deep one. You can say, well, for a new idea, how do you anticipate even what you need to search about? And that's really a question you can't really solve. So what I like to distinguish is sort of the natural flash of insight. And that's where you get these examples that I referred to. Steve Jobs was good at it. He'd search and search and search, and then, oh, something would strike him. I don't know if you know about the origin of Starbucks. Howard Schultz was working for a coffee company, high quality coffee, where it was a company where you fill up your bag, take the coffee beans home. He goes to a Milan for the first time in his life, and he sees a coffee bar. He says, oh, okay, well, we should clearly convert all our stores into coffee bars. So again, very clear. And he's very eloquent and describing his moment, which is very much, you know, the classic flash of insight where he suddenly sees it, feels like a revelation. I then distinguish sort of the natural flash of insight from the innovation method, where your company might say, well, we can't wait for people to have, by chance, these natural flashes of insight. We need a new idea about X. So that's where we get into method pub. Well, okay, what you do is you break it down. What are the pieces of the puzzle? And then you search on the pieces. So you're not searching on the whole problem. You're searching on each piece of the problem, which will give you a different source. And then you end up with a variety of things. And you might, oh, I see. So I found this from this piece, this from this piece, this from this piece. I see it. I see how it all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
Still a flash of insight, but it's, you know, it's more, you know, conscious and more organized. And once again, I stole that, as you read from the book, from someone named Lloyd Trotter,
mm-hmm.
basically invented that format at General Electric. And in my view, that was part of General Electric's success, you know, when it was so successful.
And I guess that's that there's a whole nother can of worms. I wanted to ask just one more thing on what to study, because across the different examples, and also the element of timing, as you had the example of Napoleon, which was kind of a mix of mastering innovation in your own field and studying history. But then other examples were about like Google, for example, was much more kind of putting together a lot of things that were evolving at the same time, business model wise and technology wise. So how do you think about the role of history and kind of understanding case studies versus being, you know, kind of a master of your domain as it appears right now and taking ideas
So I'll solve the problem very simply by saying there is no now.
Okay.
Everything is history.
Okay.
Google saw things that when you say that, oh, they existed, no, that somebody did last week.
Okay.
Last week is history.
Yeah. Fair.
This morning, you know, last night was history.
So how do we rephrase? Do you think, I mean, that's fair.
Because it works in your mind.
Yeah,
it's a memory.
Yeah.
It may be only in your memory for, you know, 30 seconds, but it's a memory right there next to something you learned that happened 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Your
okay,
brain
so,
doesn't care when it comes from. What time? Brain doesn't care about the time.
Yes.
It's a memory.
Do you have
from
a
the
view?
Past.
Right. Do you have a view on the use or the value of history? Well, you know.
There is no other guide to the future.
Got it.
If you're not using history as your guide to the future, what are you using?
Yeah.
I love these people who say, you know, they're data-driven decision making. Oh, great. You have data about the future? Please let me know what it is. There is no data about the future, right? Everybody's basing everything on the past. And, you know, the only data we have is the past. And then you make some sort of adjustment and calculation where you project what you think is going to happen in the future based on the data you've learned from the past. But the data isn't telling you what to do. The data is giving you information about the past that you then decide to apply somehow in your own mind to the future.
Do you think, you mentioned GE and kind of the idea that this process can be kind of structured, and you mentioned other techniques as well for kind of creative, I guess, sparking creativity in this sense in an organization versus the examples are often one or two individuals like Napoleon or Bill Gates and Paul, but like distinct individuals who find themselves in a situation and piece this together, like you said, in a more natural fashion, right? Versus kind of coming at it in a formulaic sense. Oh, I have this problem and now we as a team have to come up with something creative, which feels a little bit forced compared to, oh, here's a very passionate individual totally immersed in their domain, and then happens.
Very often it's not an individual totally immersed in their domain. The Milan example of Howard Schultz, the founder, he wasn't the founder, he was a Starbucks employee. He wasn't all that passionate. He had a good job, right? He had a job. He liked it, you know, very interesting. It wasn't paying for him his fortune. It was a very small company. Now in Milan, he sees this and now he's passionate. Now he has an idea that he's passionate about. You don't have to have the passion before.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You have the passion for the idea. The idea gives you the passion. It says, oh, great. This is what I'm going to do.
Interesting.
Right? Don't have passion before you have an idea.
That's interesting.
You have an interest. You know, I'm interested in this. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in that. You know, unless you just like doing it, you know, I'm passionate about opera. So I'm going to learn everything about opera. I'm going to, you know, go to operas. I'm going to study opera. Great. it's a pastime. But for me to get a new idea about opera,
right,
I have to be neutral. I have to be observant. I have to be strategic. I have to, have the discipline to come up with a new idea about opera. And that's the same for any field. And don't get excited about a new idea until you have it.
One thing I really enjoyed about the book is that you drew from very different domains to kind of explain the idea, right? There's scientific revolutions. There's also Eastern philosophy. There's the whole von Clausewitz, like the military strategy angle, which kind of has the basic framework. But I was especially interested in just the idea of this, the beginner's mind and everything you outlined around, okay, you're collecting your dots, right? You're studying history, you're having all this input, but then you need to put yourself into this state of not trying to force it, right? Clearing your mind and being open to. So tell me about that and how you, well, what you drew on and how you think about that moment and techniques that help with it.
Reading Clausewitz, I don't know if you've ever tried to read Clausewitz in any language. It's really murder. But you can find in there, right, the similar concept where you leave theory on the edge of the battlefield,
right?
Meaning, everything you've learned, you leave it at the edge of the battlefield and then you step in. The same as martial arts, right? The moment you step into the battle, you forget everything. Meaning that you let your brain make the correct connections. That's the presence of mind, right? That your mind is clear. Now, of course, in martial arts, it's really very fast. But it's interesting. It's really the same idea. It's that clear your mind and let your brain make its own connections according to the situation and the circumstances. And certainly Eastern philosophy, psychology is much more advanced in how you do that and how you clear your mind. And there's a lot of that actually in the third book, The Seventh Sense. It's a wonderful discipline to be able to clear your mind. And remember, clearing your mind means you have no passion.
Yeah. Right. You sort of remove the emotion and the trying to force it.
Yeah. Because what you want might not be what fun.
Was that, you mentioned, I think you talked about meditation, also martial arts and other things. Was that already a part of your life before sort of digging into the specific topic?
I knew nothing about the military, nothing about what it is as a, the first thing I discovered was Clausewitz. Because I looked, strategy in the dictionary. I said, what is the definition of strategy? And it was a very boring definition, but it's the kind of dictionary that tells you when the word entered the English language. And it was 1810. I thought that was amazing because most ordinary English words were there at the time of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Why 1810? That's so late for an ordinary word. That, of course, led me to Napoleon, to Clausewitz. And when I'm reading Clausewitz, I read about the flash of insight, the coup d'oeil, which really started me off on all this. Oh, that's the modern science of intuition. So I actually put together the two things. I had a flash of insight.
You had a flash of insight.
But anyway, I was working with a Japanese woman at the time. And when I described to her, presence of mind and flash of insight, she said, oh yeah, that's martial arts.
Oh, interesting.
I said, what? She had done kendo, that's the sticks. She said, oh yeah, they give us that lecture at the start of every class. So that led me to read into that. And so, I read the whole tradition on that as well. So, I just discovered all this. None of this is my idea.
Yeah, you piece together strategic insight about strategic
intuition.
But I think it's very it's very interesting because, like you said, some traditions have done this, I guess, for centuries, if not longer, right? Versus, I think here, meditation, it comes with this sort of mental health umbrella now, and like it's good, but not to me. I meditate, but there's often an internal voice that's like, is this really the best use of your time? But it seems to me that for you, like it's a key connective element, right, between the idea and the input is to get out of your own way, right?
Well, yeah. So clearing your mind, presence of mind is a great mental discipline. I recommend, you know, the seven senses because there's meditation. There's two very popular kinds of meditation called, one is focus or samatha, the other is mind wandering or insight meditation, which is vipassana. But there's a third kind that is my favorite. It's called vichara. And there's 100 different methods of that, but there's one that I recommend in the book Seven Sense where you're using, you'll see.
I can't wait to read it. No, yeah.
So in other words, the what they figured out is not just meditation, sitting there thinking about nothing. There's a whole set of tools and techniques for how to clear your mind much more deeply than simply, you know, focusing on your breathing, which is good.
Is that something you've incorporated into your life?
No, I don't meditate. I do the third one. I mean,
you do the third.
It's meditation, but it's the kind of thing, you know, you can do it at any time, any moment where you need it. It's on demand versus.
Is it a mantra? So you said it's not meditation.
Well, technically it's meditation. I mean, it's not meditation as we know it, meaning you sit in one place for a certain amount of time. It's on demand meditation, so to speak, for particular problems that arise.
How would one go about this? This is a perfect way to pitch the book.
it's another. I mean, happy to come back if you want me to. It's another subject.
Okay.
Very. It's great.
I'm excited to learn about it. And have you found that people, I guess I'm curious, right? You consult also aside from teaching at Columbia, right? Have you found people receptive to the idea overall? Like, do you feel like the idea of strategic intuition has caught on, or do you run into?
Oh, well, that's various... two different questions.
Yeah.
Are they receptive to it? Yes. People recognize it. They say, oh yeah, you know, yeah, you're right. I see what you mean. That's right. That is how I think. And then they go back to their offices where there are all these other methods. It's the typical problem with any kind of training. You know, you go back and no one understands what you're talking about it.
Yeah.
You're re-immersed in the methods and techniques and the mindset of what everybody else is doing. So has it caught on? No, because it's so hard to catch on because it's so different. You know, people around the world, people are still brainstorming to get creative ideas. And that, I don't see that changing. Because it's, you know, it's easy, it's quick, and it's, you know, there's a certain team element to it, which is nice.
Yeah. Do you recommend other methods, right? So like reverse brainstorming and I think it was the GE matrix.
That's the most important one by far. Yeah, reverse brainstorming is simply, instead of saying Friday afternoon, we're going to be creative at 3 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, we'll gather ideas you've had in other times and make sure we don't lose. It's just a way to gather ideas from other times because once you understand the neuroscience of it, there's no way you're going to say to everybody, okay, turn on your creative brain. Let's get great ideas in the next 2 hours.
Right. So the point is, you can't force it in that moment. You have to capture it when it arises
if you typically brainstorm on a subject.
Yeah.
But if you want a new idea on the subject, do the matrix, right? What's the problem? Break it down, search, right?
How would one go about that? What's the matrix in a nutshell?
So it's simply, you know, so let's put it in the context of brainstorming that people understand. Mm-hmm. So you could even use the language of brainstorm. Okay, we're going to brainstorm on what's the problem we need to innovate on.
Mm-hmm.
Notice you're not brainstorming solutions, but people don't notice the difference. Right. Hey, let's brainstorm. Okay. You come up with a problem. Great. Next week, we're going to brainstorm on how to break it down. Again, you're not brainstorming solutions. You're really thinking together. It's really just teamwork, but people call it brainstorming. But okay, we're now broken it down. Great. You know, what we're going to do next is we're all going to go away. We're each going to take a different subproblem and we're going to search. You're going to look for examples for that. You're going to look for examples from that. You're going to look for examples from that. And in 2 weeks, we're all going to come back. And we're going to see the examples we found And we're going to try to see if there's some combination of some of those examples that we think is something we want to do. I think people would do it. I think they'd say, oh yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, you can't penetrate the current methods.
Right. And it also, I guess it also involves an element of timing, right? And like distributing this out in so that the ideas
exactly.
can come up in different spaces. And I read some studies that say a lot of ideas come with doing unrelated activities, right? So that there's an element of
So now you're mixing the natural way and this formal way.
Oh, okay.
What you're talking about is the natural way.
Right.
In the formal way, remember you're feeding your memory with new examples.
Yeah.
And that's a conscious 2-week, you know, activity.
Right.
And then after that, now that you enriched all the examples that people are going to draw on, now that you can spend the day saying, okay, let's study all the examples we have, you know, that we found. Let's see if we can put any together. Now, notice you're not tossing ideas off the top of your head. You're putting together pieces of puzzle that you brought into the room.
Mm.
That's not brainstorming.
Right.
It's just teamwork.
Right. Got
right?
It.
You know, the problem is that people, you know, in terms of scheduling, very often, you know, we have a deadline on Monday. Let's brainstorm on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like,
there's no time to search.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of wondering if the timing element makes it possible for the natural to emerge as a sub-component.
Yeah,
of
you're absolutely right.
Right.
Yeah. Ultimately, it happens naturally. There's no other way.
Yeah, yeah.
But you fed it with, you know, with new pieces of the puzzle, new memories, new examples, rather than simply relying on what's already in your mind, which is very limiting. There's a whole world out there of achievement that you can draw on that you don't know about right now.
How does this, when you were looking for examples, so I've been thinking about this in terms of how would I recognize when this is happening in the wild, but people maybe don't use your language and aren't as specific about, like you said, Steve Jobs was very explicit about it. Many others may not be, or the people who write about it may not be cognizant of what's happening. Are there examples that didn't make it into the book, or do you look for certain markers when you're like, oh, this is, I think, where this happened?
Anytime I actually found out people would describe what actually happened in their minds, this is what happened. More typically, they never describe it. It's more, they'll say, you know, I got this idea, and then here's all the difficult steps to implement it. It's all about implementation. And the heroic implementer, which is fine. But, you know, they skip over how they got the idea. There was a TV show in the U.S., you know, maybe 15 years ago, by someone named Donny Deutsch. And the title of the show was, What's the Big Idea? So I thought, oh, this is great. He's going to tell us how people get ideas. Here's how we'd interview people. It was always somebody who quit their job to do something else that succeeded on something entrepreneurial. Here's how we would interview them. Tell me what it felt like at your job, how horrible it was to go to work every day, knowing that you wanted to do this other thing. 10 minutes of that. Then he says, okay, so tell me what you did when you left your job. What's the first thing you did? What's the second thing you did? He never asked the person, how did you get the idea?
Yeah. How did you make that jump, right? Yeah.
So here I am watching this, and all it's telling me is, I should feel bad that I haven't quit my job and look at how heroic he was in implementing that. What's missing is, wait, I need an idea.
Yeah.
How
do I get the
how
big
do
idea?
I get an idea? Not about that. That's the problem. You know, people, I think, assume that it's some magical thing that happens. And, you know, everybody's different and every idea is different. It's true. Everybody's different. Every idea is different. But the method of coming up with the idea is always the same.
If
it's a good idea.
If it's a good idea. Well, that's, I mean, I guess you only really know after the fact, right? Because part of your
No. But again, you know, I hate to pick on her because she's an easy one to pick on. But, you know, she's famous, right? Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos,
sure.
Right? Nobody asked her, how did she get the idea? All her answer was, I wanted to make it possible for people to get, well, great. I would love to solve world peace, you know. There's lots of great goals out there, but how'd you get a specific idea to do A, B, and C for your business? The only person who ever asked that was the Wall Street, no, actually, you know, basically what you're asking is what's in the box. What did you put together to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, you can only put together things that exist. She's not a scientist. She's not inventing it, right? So you're putting together things that exist. What did you put together to make that possible? There were only two people asked. One, she had a meeting with the U.S. Army, and they asked it, and she left the meeting because she couldn't answer it. And then the Wall Street Journal journalist, John Carreyrou,
yeah, who wrote
asked
the
this
book,
question. Everyone else said, well, you know, great idea. No, it's not a great idea unless you can say, I put together this, this, and this, and that's why I think this idea is possible.
In a way, it doesn't qualify.
You can't just say after the fact. You can judge the idea at the time, right? Because you're, you know, you're Henry Ford said, look, the Oldsmobile assembly line is working. The slaughterhouse moving line is working. I'm going to put together these two things that work.
Mm.
Good idea. Okay. Doesn't mean it's going to work, but that's how you measure a good idea. Is it based on real knowledge and experience that worked in some way, in some other situation? That's how you judge an idea at the moment before you implement it.
You're right.
I mean, ultimately, you know, but you have to be careful. Just because it works doesn't mean it was a good idea. The person could have gotten super lucky, right? Mm. And just because it doesn't work doesn't mean it wasn't a good idea, because there's a million things that could happen on the way. So how do you judge an idea when you have it? Is it based on real knowledge and experience, real pieces of the puzzle? That's how you judge. And then you can ask people that. Someone says, I got this great idea. And you say to them, great, okay, tell me how'd you get it? Do you remember where you were?
Mm.
This is what Gary Klein did with expert intuition,
right?
He'd say, oh, great. You know, you got a great idea, this nurse or this firefighter. You really figured that out. Stop. How'd you get the idea? They'll say, oh, it's just my intuition. So, nope, slow down. You entered the room. What were you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
What's the first thing you observed? What's the first thing you saw? Oh, okay. And then they reconstructed in their mind what happened. And it was always, you know, based on some previous example in their case, meaning based on something real. Same thing. You know, if you ask somebody, you know, somebody says, you know, I had this great idea over the weekend. You say to them, great. Do you remember where you were exactly? And they'll say, I remember exactly where I was, right? So there's I asked this question of, you know, it's very rare to get a chance to ask this question, but I happened to be the founder of, I forget what it's called. It's an exercise program that's in the mirror. Just bought by Lululemon.
It's very successful, right? Yes.
And I asked her, do you remember when you got the idea? Yeah. Oh, I remember exactly when I got the idea. I was at my kitchen table. Right. And I had a gym, and I was working on my laptop trying to figure out, what programs to run on the screens, you know, in front of the machines. Right. And then at the same time, I was looking at the feedback from the people in my gym, and I asked them, what do you like best? And they like best is all the mirrors. So it's like, oh, program on the screen, mirror.
Mm.
Program on the screen, mirror. Oh, I'll put the program on the mirror.
There's a good idea based on real feedback.
I mean, you know, it sounds simple-minded. You know, it was huge. She says, oh, wow. You know, and now she's passionate about this idea that she didn't have an hour.
Yeah, that's a great example. No, that's a really good example because... the Elizabeth Holmes example you mentioned, it was almost like backwards, right? Like it started with the goal in mind without the, exactly. The insight. It wasn't, yeah.
Yeah. She didn't have an idea that, so your goal is your future anticipation of mm-hmm. implementing the idea.
Yeah.
So now this mirror woman, she has a goal. Oh, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sell this to all the gyms.
Mm-hmm.
Or to sell it to people individually.
Yeah.
It's like now she has a goal. You know, I'm going to sell this to people. There's a gym in your home, you know, and this is now I have a goal that I'm going to set and I'm able to say, you know, I'd like to sell maybe 100 by this time. And now you have a goal. A goal without an idea is a fantasy.
Mm. Have you found when you interact with people and you ask these questions, that some people are just better either by, you know, innately or intuitively or by training are kind of better at recognizing when these ideas happen? Or like, is there something to becoming better at the, like recognizing the natural moment? Oh, this is yes. an important idea.
Well, but, or even just having the natural moment. Because it implies a certain curiosity where you're taking things in. Oh, that's how that works. Oh, that's interesting. You go to a hotel and as you watch them, you know, they do something different that you hadn't noticed before. Mm-hmm. And it's good. You say, oh, look at that. Look what they're doing. Look how they do that. Oh, that's very interesting. So really curiosity is the only skill, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then attention, right? You say, oh, yeah, you know, like, again, Howard Schultz is wonderfully described in his book. How he then sits there, and now that he's got the idea, he studies exactly what they do. What does the barista do? What's the first thing the barista does? What exactly do they serve? You know, how do people, where do people come in? You know, he starts observing in great detail because now he knows he's building a model, basically, right? And so now his curiosity becomes very deep. You can do that even before you have the idea, you know, so you go to that new hotel and you say, oh, look at that, what they're doing there. Oh, okay. You can, you know, go talk to the manager and say, look at this wonderful thing. How'd you do that? What gave you the idea? Is it working? You know, and they'd be delighted to talk. They're flattered.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you're exploring the world with that mindset, you know, you're in Paris and it's been, more than a decade, right? Since you've probably, it was 07 or so. So like how has this concept changed your life in terms of,
It made me observe it. It made me study what works.
Mm.
You know, I love studying what works. Oh, look at that. How does that work? Or that doesn't work. Why doesn't that work? You know, you want things that work, but also, you know, the flip side of the coin always is things that don't work because you're comparing it to something that doesn't work.
How would that fit into the idea framework, though? Something that
you're just searching things that work. In other words, you want examples, you want positive examples.
Yeah.
You know,
if you were to rewrite the book today, would you pick different examples or would it still be the same domains?
I rewrote it as Seven Sense.
Yeah.
I rewrote the book two times. I rewrote it as Creative Strategy and I rewrote it as Seven Sense. Corey is very present. It's just, you know, because it's about all human achievement in every domain, right? And it's facing counter methods in every domain. There's really an endless, you know, I could write three more, all with the same idea, you know, because it's carving into what I would call the misconceptions that people have about A, B, C, D, and E.
So what was the main, is it more, meaning as you rewrote it, what were the key elements that you thought had to be expressed differently or were you learning new things? Was it more about implementation or did you change something about the framework?
Well, so you read Strategic Intuition, right?
Yes.
So it's really, you know, it's the whole idea. Then Creative Strategy really is about that matrix method.
Okay.
You know,
got
and
it.
Then Seven Sense is more, how does this apply to me personally?
You
know, in my personal life. Because remember, people at work are in their personal lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not just a cog in the machine. They also have brains and desires and it's part of their life. So it fits into part of their life. So how you behave at work depends on what you want out of life and what your attitude towards life is. So that's the third one, is about that.
Is it meaning applying the idea to personal decisions or applying the
well,
the
so for example, presence of mind.
Yeah.
You know, that whole discipline of presence of mind applies to everything. It applies to relationships.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a really quick thing, you know, Western psychology, accepts the idea that expressing your negative emotions is good in general. Eastern psychology tells you how to avoid having negative emotions. Because negative emotions are toxic. And now neuroscientists confirms that it is actually literally toxic to your brain. You know, when people say they have a stress-related disease, it's really because negative emotions have reduced their immunity, have created excess cortisol, which is a hormone in the brain that lowers their immunity to everything. It degrades their immune system. There's an example. And it's neuroscientists know this. But typically Western psychology is still telling people, you know, to love their emotions.
Well, I guess there's a difference between, well, indulging in it and focusing on it, right? And letting it be part of your identity, but also on the other end of the spectrum, completely denying it or bottling it up, right? Which to me feels like before the
That's
last
few decades.
That's
a perfect statement from Western psychology.
Yeah.
There's only
two alternatives. Like that was it feels like that's the arc that we went through here, where first, you know, you kind of, it was sort of stiff
so
upper lip, and now you're
the
on the other end.
Western psychology, that this either you express your emotions or you suppress them.
Yeah. It's a false dichotomy, is what you're saying.
What it is that a negative emotion, all negative emotions come from not getting what you want.
Sure.
So a good strategist will say, well, is it possible to get what I want? Is this a reasonable thing to ask for? What part of it can I get? What part of it can't I get? Start strategizing about the problem and actually having negative emotions about the problem interferes with your thinking. The other thing that cortisol does is it blocks memory. And if you've ever been too upset to think, it's because you were too upset to think. So you need a clear mind to solve the problem that made you upset. And getting upset interferes with solving. So the best way to, the only service negative emotion gives you is like pain for an athlete. You know, your ankle hurts. Okay. So now you have a problem. But you don't want your ankle to hurt more than a second.
Yes. Right?
So you don't want that negative emotion to be more than a second. It simply tells you, oh, there's a problem.
Right.
Now, the faster you convert from the negative emotion to thinking through, what can I change? What can't I change? The better it is for your health and the better it is for your thinking to solve the problem.
And to you, do you see this mostly as kind of a mental exercise?
It's mental discipline. Yeah. It can happen as you're walking down the street. A negative emotion hits you. You say, wait, there's something I want that I can't get at. What is it? What part of it is within my control? What part of it is outside my control? The moment you start that, the cortisol goes down and you're able to think.
And I mean, so it sounds like creative. Like if I was a team leader and I wanted my people to be more creative, it sounds like an exercise in lowering their cortisol.
Absolutely.
Interesting. And do you, I mean, I guess I'm curious, right? You mentioned attachment and desire as the source of suffering. And do you include in that sort of triggers like, you know, empathy relating to someone's pain or suffering when, you know, you have, I don't know, family with health issues.
So grief is is a clear one, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's religious rituals of grief.
Mm.
Grief does nobody any instead, is there anything you can do to help the other people who are grieving? Feeling grief yourself is of no service anyway. You have a desire to help other people. Help them get through their grief. Feeling grief yourself doesn't help that.
But doesn't that... Wait, I'm not following. I understand the idea of being there for somebody else who's grieving, but that kind of implies that you're different from them, right? They're a person who has to grieve versus you don't have to grieve.
Versus, absolutely. You are an expert in mental discipline and they're not. That's okay. You know, they're just human beings. They're just people. They're grieving. Help them with their grief.
But you and I are too. So I'm just wondering, so you don't see it as part of, you know, certain emotions need to be, I guess, processed in some way until
What do you mean process? I just talked about processing.
Yeah.
That's the process.
That's
I feel grief. Wait a second. Grief is a waste of time.
Okay.
Instead, I should help other people deal
Got
with
it.
Their grief.
Interesting.
That's
I gotta
the
read
process.
This. I gotta read the Seventh Sense. I'm very curious
process.
To dig in more
you
into
know,
this.
So,
one.
So people will say, you know, I hate injustice. Shouldn't I hate injustice? The answer is no, you should love justice.
Okay.
If you love justice, you'll be able to think clearly.
Mm.
If you hate injustice, it'll cloud your mind.
It'll redirect your focus.
Yeah. It'll,
okay.
It'll
I got to say, I'm very curious to dig into the Seventh Sense and into more of these practices. And I really enjoyed this. I think it's a fascinating topic and I very much appreciate what you shared. I wanted to thank you very much for both for writing the book as well as for sharing and taking the time today. And very excited to share the idea with my readers.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.